Thank you so much for getting up so early and coming. If you get at all bored as I'm speaking, Google Palmerston. This room is named after Palmerston. He was a Prime Minister. He came to this college just over 200 years ago. He came from a school called Harrow, where apparently he beat up the younger boys slightly less than the average boy beat up the younger boys. He's quite a violent man. Palmerston, I think, coined the phrase, was known for the phrase gunboat diplomacy. He insisted that China open up its markets to take British goods, primarily British goods that were grown in India and was called opium. And if you do open up your Wikipedia page and type in Palmerston, go down to the Arrow controversy and see what he says about the barbarian Chinese. And just think, who were the real barbarians? Was it the Chinese who tried to stop him bringing in the opium to their country? Or was it the young man who spent 3 years in the cloisters in this college? And in his head, he thought he was the height of civilization, bringing free trade to the world. I've got 40 minutes to talk to you about inequality, the 1%, Brexit, what it might bring. I'll show you a couple of slides and then we'll do a quick poll. According to the OECD, the UK has the highest level of economic inequality of any European country, as it's measured by income. They use the Gini coefficient, and one way to explain that is a very high Gini coefficient of 0.5, say, would occur if we divided this room up exactly along this line, and everybody here had a household income of, say, £70,000, £75,000 a year, and everybody over here, you've got a household income of £25,000 a year. That's a Gini coefficient of about 0.5. We're not as bad as that, but I'll show you later we're fairly close to it. The question is, how much does that matter for what's happened recently? What I'm going to do is talk to you about the background of what's happened in recent years. I'm going to talk about the spread of fear about immigration that occurred in the 70s, particularly in the 90s and last decade. I'm going to talk to you about how hostility to the EU has been whipped up. I'm a geographer, so I'm going to talk to you about the geography of the Brexit vote. I'm going to tell you what I think about inequality and why I think it might matter. I'm going to talk to you a bit, very quickly, about empire and the history of this. But lastly, I'm going to conclude saying that actually the result was perfect. 52-48 is absolutely perfect. So I'm giving away the conclusion. You've got to try and guess how I'm going to get there. There is apparently some interactive way of doing a vote with you. So let's try and do that. Somebody's going to help. I've never done this before. How many of you have ever done this before? Put your hands up if you've done it. Okay, only a minority of you have done it before. The chances of this working are pretty low then. If you don't know what you're doing and I don't know what I'm doing, but let's try. Anyway, it's not as boring as listening to me going on and on at you. Okay, so you've got to go. I can see if you can't. What we're going to do in a minute is put up a web address. So you need to have an internet connection. And you need to go www.menti.com. www.menti.com. And the code you've got to type in is 28704. Okay, and then you can see your reaction. So in the next kind of 10 seconds, if you can all click one of those. This is a way I get an idea of who I'm talking to. If I was really brave, we'd put this up and it would have how boring are you getting, Danny, and it slowly rise during the lecture. 5 more seconds. So we've got about 70 people internet literate in the audience. That's roughly half of you. Right. 1 last second. Okay, we'll hold it there. Okay. You can carry on if you like, I can't stop it. Most of you are liars. Most of you are liars. Or you don't know you're lying, so I guess that isn't lying. You've deceived yourself. Unless you are dramatically different from other very young people, what you would have done, notice it's about June 2016, you wouldn't have voted. That's what the vast majority, maybe 75, maybe 80% of people who are 18, 19, 20 did. They didn't vote. You think you would have voted. And you go, well, I would vote. You know, this is 2 years ago. And I'll show you, I think I've got a graph that shows you the age. I'm not having a go at you, it's just quite interesting for me. That, you know, you're young, I'm guessing you're relatively well educated, you're from schools that can be bothered to get you up early on a Saturday morning to get you here. So that is not, that's predictable. But the really interesting thing, who are the 6 on this? Oh, I won't embarrass you. Anyway, well done. Because it's about the past. I'm going to ask you a bit later about what you do next. But that's interesting. Let's go back to the slides. We've got 2 more of those, which means I've got to go through this very, very quickly, because the voting is more interesting than my opinions. And we're going to skip that. Here's a graph about people born abroad, going from 1841 all the way to 2011. Goes up to about 8 million now. The numbers kind of rise and rise at various times. There are fears about immigrants coming from abroad. We got really worried 100 years ago about Jewish people arriving. World was going to end, didn't end, it's all okay. When I was young, people worried about people arriving because we invited them from the Caribbean. We got really worried about people from the Caribbean arriving. Turns out the world didn't end, although we're still being a bit nasty to some of them. Then most recently we got this. See that little triangle there? That's the Eastern Europeans coming in. Terrible. Putting down wages, apparently, destroying societies and so on. And that's our current clash. And you may look at that and go, look, it's going up and up and up. It's actually only 8 million people out of about 64 million. And it's going up everywhere, because people are moving around further and further away. That's another way of looking at exactly the same data. Exactly the same data. But all these people who are coming in, they're kind of old and ill and decrepit and using the welfare state. No, they're not. They're young, highly educated compared to us. We didn't pay for their schooling. They come, they do the crap jobs around here. The only reason that these rooms are clean, that people are fed, is migrants from Eastern Europe at the moment. Here's a map of immigration across Europe. The map has been stretched so that everywhere gets an equal amount of people. If you look at the UK, the big blob in the UK near us is London. So all the areas without people, we shrink. All the areas with people, we make bigger. And so you're actually looking at the map of the human geography. The yellow areas are where less than 1 in 20 people were born abroad in 2014. The yellow areas are areas of practically no immigration. And most of the north of England and Wales, Scotland, is rather like Eastern Europe. There are hardly any immigrants there. It's not what you'll believe if you read the Daily Mail and the Daily Express. Just happens to be the data, and the data isn't wrong. The place with the highest proportion of immigrants in the UK is West Central London, where over a fifth of people were born abroad. The part of the UK with the highest immigration rate of all is Northern Ireland and the rest of Ireland, because there is no border in Ireland. You can live either side of the border, there is no border. You can have a passport from either side. Nobody would be stupid enough to ever suggest doing anything with that border in Ireland. Highest rate in Europe is Switzerland. Cities, this is Paris, tend to have high rates. There's Madrid. And this little block down here is the Costa del Sol and the Spanish Mediterranean coast. Pretty chock-a-block of immigrants. You may know some of them. Anybody got a grandparent who's living out there? In a bit. Some of them will be coming back soon. But first of all, only the ones who are really ill and need health treatment. But that'll be great, because the NHS is just ready for them. Anyway, that's the map of immigration. The UK doesn't have unusually high immigration. Actually has unusually low in most of it. Where the immigrants have tended to come is largely where they're needed and wanted. That's what immigrants always do. This is a graph over time of support for Leave and Remain. Because if you're thinking, why did David Cameron call it? He called it because, at the time he called it, Remain was doing really well in the polls. He thought he would win. And then it kind of goes down, 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 like this, down, down, down. Doesn't work. This graph is too complicated, and I've got to stop showing it, but you kind of have to believe it. This is support for far-right parties, parties to the right of the Conservatives. The Referendum Party, UKIP, British National Party, English Defence League kind of people. Way back in 1997, Jimmy Goldsmith started a party called the Referendum Party. He sent a VHS video cassette to every household in Britain about how terrible Europe was. Got about 2% of the vote. They kind of wander around down here until you get to 2004, where suddenly there's a little rise. It's down again until 2009, there's a rise. It's down again. 2004, 2009 are both European parliamentary elections. The British people didn't slowly and steadily decide they didn't like Europe. It was whipped up before each election. Here's the big whipping up, 2012, 13, 14, best time for UKIP, dropped down here, they're right down here now. Poor old Nigel Farage is trying to find a party. So the history of polling is like that. This other graph, I find it fascinating. But I'm good because I drew it. We first entered European elections in 1979. Parties to the right of normal European Conservatives. At that time it was the National Front, who were vicious and nasty. Actually, I was beaten up at National Front as a school child. 1979, National Front gets almost nothing. 1984, nothing. 1989, nothing. 1994, 1.1% parties to the far right. My definition of far right here is to the right of mainstream European Conservatives, which is the EPP bloc in the European Parliament. Rises in 1999, after Jimmy Goldsmith did that. Gets up to 20% of people who vote in European elections in 2004. Most people don't vote in European elections, but 20%. 2009 gets to 37%. In 2014, in the last European elections, because the Conservative Party left the main European EPP bloc and joined some very odd Polish politicians, and I think Alternative for Deutschland, I forget. Anyway, our Conservative Party was now to the right of European Conservative Parties, UKIP was the right. 52.4% of people in 2014 voted for a political party to the right of normal European Conservatives in 2014. And we didn't notice it. We didn't realise what that might mean. When people talk to you about the rise of populism across Europe and the rise of the far right, and they worry about what's happening in Finland or in Hungary or in Austria, what they hardly ever say is, we had the biggest rise. in voting for parties to the right of normal European Conservatives. We sent by far the largest number of MEPs to the European Parliament, who form the blocs that we talk about as worrying. And it's really, really odd, very strange, because we think of ourselves as normal. And here's the map of the vote. And the vote was quite remarkable. There are no other maps like it. London majority remain, Cardiff remain, Bristol remain, Manchester, Liverpool remain, Scotland all remain. This is the kind of share of the vote. Really high remain in London. There's Oxford. You're currently sitting in Cambridge. Liverpool remain peak, surrounded by Cambridgeshire, which likes remain. But all the blue areas, majority leave. Never that often very strong leave, but just quietly majority leave. So let's try a poll again. Are you ready? Okay. Now then, and look at the question carefully, and to make you feel better. I could have got it wrong. You know, you are here on a Saturday morning, you may be much more enthusiastic than your peers of the same age. And events have changed. I mean, one of the brilliant things that has occurred because of Brexit is it's galvanised the young generation like never before. Well, not never before, the Second World War did. Young people voted in 1945 like never before because they didn't want another war, apart from anything else, because they'd been sent to fight in it. But it's been a long time since young people have been that bold about politics. The vote among young people collapsed after 1991 when the poll tax was introduced, which you could be, in effect, fined for voting. 92 elections when we first saw 18 to 24-year-olds not voting. It's been a long time coming. So what we're doing here is Theresa May announces today in Parliament there will be another referendum. We're going to have to do it bloody quickly because we've only got to the 29th of March. She's conceded with Jeremy that 16-year-olds and above. Is anybody below 16? No? Okay. Who's 16? Who's 17? Who's 18? Okay. Well, hello, 18-year-olds at the back. Right. Okay, you're lying again. We don't know it. There is no group of people in Britain where so many actually vote, but you think you're going to vote. When we ask people after the vote, over 90% of people say that they voted. And I think people actually change in their heads and come to believe that they did. But anyway, please do vote. This is interesting. I think you are pretty typical of your age group nationally. Apart, and maybe you're typical over people think they'll vote. You might have had a really good party the night before. You might have a hell of a hangover. There are various reasons you might not be in the same city. You might be visiting a boyfriend or girlfriend somewhere. There are lots of reasons why people don't vote. Anyway, you are about 80% remain, 20% leave. Let's go back to the slides. I've got one last poll which I'll do at the end for you. There's the map. And actually, if you work it out, if you draw a line kind of here, or even a line like that, the majority of Leave voters were in the south of England. But this isn't explained to people. The majority of Leave voters were middle class because of turnout. Working class people are much more likely not to vote. The majority of Leave voters normally voted Conservative. This is a southern middle class Conservative vote. Not how the press portray it, because the press were in shock. It's not a conspiracy. Remain was supposed to win. As the results came in, Sunderland comes in early. Sunderland, surprisingly high Leave vote. The camera pans in on one blonde woman and her two friends who don't have much hair, and the story set. Within that kind of second at the beginning. Here's the voting by age. 18 to 24-year-olds, those are all the ones who didn't vote. Here's the leavers, here's the remainers. You have to get a bit younger than me, 35 to 44-year-olds, to actually find peak remain. Because they vote. The proportion who don't vote is relatively small. But you have to watch out for the old. The old don't have much to do. They are not your friends, necessarily. And they will go and vote. because they've got nothing else to do. In my friends in Switzerland, where they have constant referendums, say the one problem with referendums and being asked what you want is that the bloody old always go and vote. So they have to go and vote to counter the effect of the old voting. It's at least an incentive. And there you see very, very big lead for the old and for the group I'm very close to joining when I get old. The question of why did old people vote to leave? It wasn't selfish. They know they're not going to be around for much longer. It's not going to make them rich. And that's what you've got to keep in your head. And remember about Palmerston from the beginning. You know, we went out and we civilised the world to make it a better place and accept free trade, that kind of thinking. I've shown you too many graphs. This is just one which says that the highest proportion of areas voting, this is 4, 5 and 6, this is Middle Britain Leave, not the poorest areas. However, this is the poshest set of places in Britain, and they really did vote Remain. So if you're looking overall, the very poshest just vote Remain. Places where people go on 2 skiing holidays in winter vote Remain because they don't have to get a visa or to get a nanny who comes from Britain and so on. But if you forget about the very poshest areas and just look at that, it's Middle Britain that did it. Click that. I'll just tell you the last one of these. Leave Central is Winchester. More people in the county of Hampshire voted to leave than in the whole of Bolsover, Doncaster, Hull, Chesterfield, Salford, Stoke-on-Trent and Sunderland combined. And those areas in the north have a bigger electorate. Nobody has ever said more people voted leave in Hampshire. A huge amount is talked about the vote. Based on surveys and so on, but the one thing we know for absolutely sure is who voted in which place. And for every county in the south of England, you can find a set of areas in the north that's different, where fewer people voted Leave. And just, I'm a geographer, it really annoys me that, you know, I hope I don't go to my grave trying to explain this was a southern vote. It's not about Middlesbrough, Redcar, Stoke. It's about huge numbers of elderly, relatively well off, lower middle class people in places like Hampshire. The inequality statistics, in case you didn't know, inequality in this country is very high. The top 10%, say that would be about 3 columns of you, we call you the 10%. You had half of all income 100 years ago. The rest of you have the other half to share amongst yourselves. In this area here, all the women, your servants. Right, the most common job 100 years ago for women was to be a servant. That's 100 years ago. Inequality reduces and reduces and reduces to the 1970s. As near as we got to utopia as far as inequality is concerned. Then it rises to now. And now, the 3 columns of people along the edge, you're getting 40% of everything, all the income every year, 60% share out amongst the rest of you. That's our current inequality. The Gini coefficient, if you remember telling you about that at the start, of OECD countries, Mexico's the worst, Chile's very bad, but getting better. Turkey's awful, think about who runs these countries. The US is pretty terrible, very unequal. Oh, Lithuania came in that year. Russia has great inequalities between rich and poor. And then us. We're almost identical to Russia, and we are slightly more unequal than Israel. Israel, including the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. We're really divided as a country. And I could show you the rest of Europe and just how more equal they are, but no time. There are implications of this. There are interesting correlations. This is one about people's ability at maths. How many of you got a letter for your GCSE maths, you know, ABC? The oldies at the back. Okay. right, forget you lot. Let's do the numbers. How many got a 5 or below at GCSE maths? 5 or below? Go on, brave people. 6 or below? 7? 7? 8? Knives? No. I'm talking to Geek Central. Wow. Okay. I thought knives were supposed to be just like... There isn't anything above nine, is there? No, you are. Okay. Well, come to Cambridge. You'll feel very happy at a university like this, anyway. You'll be normal. However, even though you have these amazing marks for maths, because you've grown up in a very unequal country, you've been taught maths in a certain way. You've been taught maths to get the maximum number you can at 16. For those of you who are carrying on maths, who are going to do A-level, you're still learning more. How many people are not doing maths A-level? Ooh, how many people are doing maths A-level? Oh, you really are not normal. Right, this doesn't apply to you, but it applies to most of your contemporaries. And you'll notice your friends who are a bit more normal than you. I did maths at university, so I'm not being that broad. I feel at home. Anyway. We teach people maths to get a grade. If you test them again up to age 24 maths, they're really bad. They're worse in the US, but they're really bad. If you test people like you, but at the age of 22, 23, 24 at maths, in other countries, they can still do maths. And in other countries, they've got a strange idea that you teach things like maths so that you can do maths later in your life, not as a kind of sorting mechanism to decide who goes where, but not actually to teach maths that well. I think I've got 10 minutes left, but somebody tell me if not. Not enough time to talk about the British Empire, but there's a map of the countries that were in the Empire. Even though you've got your 8s and 9s at maths, you almost certainly haven't been told much about the Empire. And if you were told about the Empire, you probably weren't told how all these places didn't voluntarily elect to join it, how they didn't all leave magnanimously as we kind of happily shook hands and said goodbye. It's the world's largest, biggest empire there's ever been. The problem is that we kind of won, so we don't tell the story of it. The first colony to escape were the 13 colonies of the Americas. And once they escaped and got their freedom, we got really tough to try to stop anybody else getting away. The last colony, well, it's not the last, there's a BBC news story this morning saying the UK is objecting to Gibraltar being described as a colony. And I love the way the BBC did it. I'm not objecting. I think Gibraltar's a colony. But apparently we're all objecting. So we still have a colony called Gibraltar and a few other things. But Hong Kong, in theory, was the last one. None of you were around when Hong Kong went in 1997. We only had Hong Kong because we sent gunships because of the man this room's named after. Hong Kong went in 1997, and the stories of Hong Kong as the flag was pulled down on the last part of the British Empire were all about the daughter of Chris Patten crying about how sad it was that this was ending, this wonderful period of history. She's just a few years older, actually she might be your age. She cried for 3 hours that day. She wasn't crying about the empire. She was crying about a bloke called Alex, who she was going to have to leave, because daddy was taking her away from Hong Kong for some reason she didn't really understand. You know, you don't cry for 3 hours about a colony. She's written this up since. And if you like, I think that's the nicest story of all the stories about the British Empire that will have to be told. GDP from manufacturing. We are here, it is awful. That is China. What we actually make is not that high tech. We like to say it is. We make very little that people in India want to buy. People in India make much more than we want to get. I'm really worried that if we do a hard Brexit, all we're going to have to sell is dodgy university degrees to people in Nigeria. It was supposed 2 days ago, the reason I picked out Nigeria is that Nigeria was supposed 2 days ago said, you know, Empire 2.0 can work, we can have a trading relationship, you can get food from Nigeria. And I was thinking, what can we give back to Nigeria? I thought, oh, an MSc in geography. You know. I'm being slightly ironic. I live in the city of Oxford. By far the most productive thing in Oxford is the Mini car plant. A Mini is produced every 1 minute, 2 seconds. The Mini costs, I'm guessing, 35,000, I could be wrong. Every 1 minute, 2 seconds, produce a Mini with 1,200 robots. Every hour, we produce a postgraduate student. Costs about the same. So the University of Oxford is 60 times less efficient than the car factory. This wouldn't be a problem, except the car factory is owned by BMW. And on the 29th of March, it shuts down. And it's supposed to open 2 or 3 weeks later, but we'll see. And the 1,200 robots that make the cars have all been built to just fit inside the back of an articulated truck, so you can move the factory in a couple of days. That's the sort of thing that scares us. Go forward again. I haven't got time to go into the boat and the shenanigans, but you have to ask, why did these people want it? Matthew Elliott was the chief executive of Vote Leave. Dominic Cummings was the campaign director. What motivated them? And there needs to be much, much more looking into their motivation and thinking. This man, I think, just wanted to be prime minister. And what he wanted was to help lead the Leave campaign and for it to just lose. And Remain wins. David Cameron kind of staggers on and Boris is champion of the people, that kind of thing. He looked so upset on the day of the result because it wasn't good news for him. And we'll see what happens to Boris, but anyway. There was a lot of stuff about people's personal careers, but there was also this real ambition from the leading Brexiteers to take this country away from being indentured to the EU so that we could truly get back to our glorious state at the top of the world. Where does that thinking come from? In 2015, George Osborne, the Chancellor, set a target that Britain would be, of all the larger countries in the world, the richest by 2030, if we followed his economic plan. And they got to say, where the hell does that thinking come from? That you sort of think it's really either desirable or possible to do that within a certain short amount of time. With house prices, he reportedly, as Chancellor, saw no problem with the fact that London was the most expensive city in Europe, because house prices, for him, are an indicator of your economic success. The higher they are, the better you're doing. And he got to say, where does that thinking come from? Thinking is changing. You can see the change in my age. This is a huge BBC poll. Most people are still proud of being English or in England. But it's kind of slipping the age group that you're about to join, all the people at the back of it. Almost at the end, and we'll then do the last poll and then I'll stop. Standard & Poor, who are a financial firm, 2 or 3 weeks before the vote, produced this graph. And it was a graph of which countries would be most affected if Britain voted to leave, apart from the UK. And it's really prescient, because the most affected country is Ireland. Although Dublin is actually doing very well at the moment, but Ireland. Then Malta. Malta's tiny. Then Luxembourg, which is also tiny. Then Cyprus, which is tiny. Then Switzerland, which is not in the EU. And then Belgium, which is not tiny, but it's not exactly big. And then the Netherlands. And that matters, because if you spend over a year negotiating, essentially with Germany, France, Italy and Spain, and it ain't going to affect them much, you're going to come back from negotiation without very much, except for a 588-page document, which only has 115 words about the finance industry in it. Really, really odd where we are now. And I've got no time for this. What could happen? Anything can happen. Hard Brexit's possible. A majority signing up for a deal or a slightly modified version of the deal is possible. Or, anytime up to 10 o'clock on Friday, 29th of March, she can write a letter on her own. Only her can do it, only the Prime Minister. She can cancel Article 50. Without asking the Cabinet. And it's not impossible, given you're facing Armageddon for the City of London. It's not, that isn't impossible. Let's leave you with that one. How many of you have been on a protest? Well done, higher, be brave. If you can protest, you put your hands higher. Good, 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 some. Okay, you're typical, you're typical. The French protest. Half of all French adults go and protest. Very effective. Lots of good things in France, health service that works and so on. Spain, Italy and Denmark, a third of adults protest. Even in Germany, 30% of adults have been on the protest. We don't protest. One in six. And this is older people than you who've had years and years in which they could have said, I really don't mind something, I'm going to go on a little march and hold a banner up. Five out of six people have never done that. And this is really interesting in terms of what might happen if Brexit is tricky, because at least we probably aren't going to get riots. Let's do the last poll and end with that. So, very sorry if I've overrun slightly. The last poll is about your grandparents. So before you click, some of you may have four, some of you, if you're lucky, have six or eight. It all depends on, you know, what happens in life to your mum and dad. A few, well, I hope none of you've got none. I hope you've all got one grandparent, right? But I want you to think about all your grandparents put together. And then try and answer this question in terms of the majority of your grandparents. Oh, I'd literally given five categories. I put you didn't know or something. Anyway, made it simpler. It's really interesting. You think your grandparents didn't vote, and you think you would vote. You know, and I've already shown you the danger that says that old people vote. Come on, get that blue line down for me. Okay, you've got liberal grandparents. That probably isn't true. Ask them nicely. You probably haven't talked about it because we're English, you know, and you avoid conversations like this. But just quietly say in a kind of pleasant way without going, did you? Just say, did you vote on the day? And ask them why. Because the really, really interesting thing is why. Because people who voted leave for you. Because they think if things carry on in Britain the way they are, it's going to be worse for you. Yeah, the one thing they didn't vote selfishly leave for themselves. They didn't vote to get rid of all the people who are likely to be their care workers when they get older. They actually voted for you. But whether it gets them what they want, which is a better life for you, is interesting. I personally don't think leaving will get you a better life. But I do think disrupting what's been happening in Britain could. Because we've been getting more and more and more unequal. And okay, the people with the nines at GCSE may get into the top 10%. Or somebody decides you're just a bit too geeky and you never pass a job interview. But you can't all be in the top 10%. And you certainly can't all be in the top 1%. So you can't carry on with things going as they are. I think 52-48 is perfect. If it had been the other way round, we'd be talking about another referendum. The BBC robbed it, whatever. We'd never have investigated the campaign to leave and found out how dirty it was. If Remain had won, immigrants would be being blamed for everything at an even worse rate than they were before. That's stopping. It wouldn't have ended. As it is, this isn't going to be over for 10, 15, 20 years. I'm afraid you're going to hear this for the rest of your younger adult life. But we are asking ourselves where we are. The majority of people, when they were given the choice between vote for things to carry on as they are, or vote for something completely different to this, voted for something completely different to this. And no other country in Europe has done this, apart from the one with the greatest economic inequalities and the legacy of the biggest empire the world has ever known. Thank you very much. So if anybody wants to ask a question, please just stick your hand up. I promise to keep my answers short so that we get as many people as we can in. Have we got a question?
Do you think that Brexit will tackle inequality or worsen it in the next 10 to 15 years?
We're at the highest rate in Europe. Well, whenever you are at the height of something, the most likely thing is you come down. So it's a bit like in general with predictions. So it's, regardless of what happens, it's probably going to reduce. It could reduce very quickly. Mark Carney has prophesied that the housing market will fall by 30% with a hard Brexit. But only better off people own houses or have a mortgage. Half of the population rent and have no... So if we were to do a hard Brexit and house prices fall by 30%, that's the fastest equalisation of wealth since the Black Death. I want gradual coming together in Britain. I don't want it to happen by disaster. But it's not just the house prices. Economically, I think whatever happens, this country is going to be less rich, more quickly less rich than we thought we were going to be. And you can't really reduce the incomes of the poor any further. Two people died on the streets of Oxford last week. They both went to my school as children, and they died as homeless. You can't reduce the incomes of the poorest anymore. Country gets poorer, the people who are going to have to take most of the hit are going to be the better off. The question is how you do it, and whether you do it in a way which is full of resentment, or whether you actually say, things were not that great. What really matters, let's work out how to come together a bit. I'll be short to the next one. We've got a next one. One over here.
Do you think a no deal Brexit is the best option for us right now?
A no deal?
Yeah.
No, because I'm old and boring. So the advantages of a no-deal Brexit are that we leave an unfair relationship. We didn't actually pay in the amount of money we should have paid into Europe. We had a special deal where we didn't pay our fair share. And at the same time, the really unfair thing was that we were taking 3 million young, healthy, fit individuals, helping our economy work and paying them really badly and treating them badly. And we were sending our elderly over to the mainland to die. David Cameron and Nick Clegg's fathers both died in France. So if I want to do an argument for a hard Brexit, it is the relationship was not right beforehand. Hard Brexit brings it to a head over what you're going to do. When, within a year, 2, 3 years of a hard Brexit, everything that was promised doesn't materialise, and when you no longer believe Nigel Farage when he says, oh, it's not working because people like Danny didn't try hard enough and made the great new Britain work, then after a hard Brexit, we would learn really, really fast what we're really worth. But the reason I don't want it, it's not for you, you'll be okay. We currently have falling life expectancy for the elderly. More elderly people are dying last year than the year before and the year before per elderly person. Frail people in nursing homes and so on. And there'll be a big increase in that. Infant mortality is rising. Babies are more likely to die last year than the year before the year before. 1 in 3 midwives in London is EU and not a UK citizen. So hard Brexit would bring it to a head. The problem is a lot of people would suffer, including a rise in deaths in Britain. Just from people who are already very near to being more likely to die because of lack of proper care. Got another one? The man over here.
I was interested by your stats on protesting. Do you think we would get better results, less inequality, better managed country if we protested more?
I do, but I was taken on the Old Marston March at the age of one, so I am a serial protester. But look at France. People often say, when they're all coming out in the yellow vests, you know, this is terrible. But part of the reason why France has labour laws which are good for people and limit how long you have to work, and pensions which are really good, and in France, if you have a third child, you're given more benefits from the third child. Here, we say no benefits for a third child. French have more beds in hospitals per person, more nurses, more doctors. The average French median family, the median family in France, is on about 4,000 more euros than the median in the UK. Their home costs less, it's of a higher quality, and it's warmer. But that's nothing to do with them. I can't help thinking that's useful. The one collective to that is that the most equitable, happiest countries in the world where people live longest, which are the Nordic countries and Japan, very little protest. But there may be very little protest because there isn't very much to protest about.
I think we have time for one more question.
Do you think the rise in inequality might be linked with the declining workers' union membership over the last 30 years?
Yeah, is the rise of inequality linked to the decline of union membership? It's connected. I mean, what unions do when they're effective is stop you reducing the wages of people who've got less. But you've got to ask, why were the unions attacked? Why in this country did government work so hard to try to kill off trade unions? The 1984 miners' strike was all about killing the union and killing the union movement. By the 1970s, we'd become really equal. I grew up in one of the most equal countries in Europe. Only Sweden, for large countries, was more equal than the UK. You went to the nearest school. The schools had just been made all comprehensive. People had similar holidays. You went camping. Poor people had more holidays than they have. The really rich really didn't like that. They really didn't like what had happened by the 70s. They tell the stories of the 70s as terrible, and it was full of trade unions going on strike, which it was. But that's what you do to stop people taking the mickey. In the 1970s, we had full employment, and the 60s and 50s. So if you didn't like your boss, you swore at your boss, and you went and got another job. Whereas we don't have that anymore. People who were best off had lost the most. The very best off had lost their country houses. When you go to a country house and you see it says donated to the National Trust, it wasn't actually donated to the National Trust. They couldn't pay the taxes. So you've got to imagine you're one of the best off in society in the 1970s. Your granddad used to be Viceroy of India. Your uncle ran part of, I don't know, Ghana. And you are a stockbroker in a three-bed semi in Fulham. And you're quite angry. And that anger translated into a political belief that we needed to get back to where we'd been before. And what was holding us back was the trade unions and the socialists. And they were really bad, so they had to be crushed. And then what was holding us back were the immigrants. And they were coming and reducing wages and taking school places. And then what was holding us back was this European Union, which if we didn't belong to it, we would be great again. And again, you could be Viceroy of India or whatever. I'm stereotyping slightly, but if I look back through my life and think, what was driving the people who really wanted London to become as rich as possible again? It's because they can remember that their families were once the richest people on the planet and have a sense that they failed, they haven't performed, they haven't got the equivalent of a GCSE grade 9 in maths if they don't get Britain back up to the top again, because it's all about winning and it's all about competition. And there's something inherently special about the English that means that we should be at the top, and if we're not, somebody else is keeping us down. And I think the best thing about Brexit is we're going to learn that there isn't something inherently special about the English that means that unfettered they are naturally superior. We're finally going to get that particular bit of racist thinking out of our psyches. It's just taken a long time. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Danny, for giving such an interesting talk on inequality and Brexit. Incredibly topical right now.